This is tape number one, the interview with Sir Peter Ramsbottom, who was British ambassador in Iran at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s. I'm not sure of the exact dates, but he will tell me during the course of the interview. He was also in charge of the Persian desk at the British Foreign Office during the early 50s, the crisis with Mossadegh, the petrol and the negotiations about petrol and the consortium. The interview is taking place at Sir Peter's house in England, in the country, in Hampshire. And Sir Peter is looking very well and very young for his 70s. And shall we start with just the beginning, how you got involved with Persia in the first place?
I got involved.
And when?
In Persia. Well, I go back, of course, to 1951, when I was head of the oil department in the Foreign Office, and just started it. And then the Mossadegh affair occurred. And I went out with the Stokes mission to Tehran, I think in August or July 1951. Try and see if we could not make some arrangements with the Mossadegh regime for the Anglo-Iranian oil company to save that situation. But it was not possible, and it had gone too far. Mossadegh, who was his own guy, his very Persian way, was an old-fashioned nationalist, an old aristocrat who'd done very well for himself, and had been very brave in standing up to Reza Shah and being exiled and so on. But it was a sort of nationalism that we didn't understand in Britain. And he had no concept of running the economy of a rising country the size of Persia, and didn't understand what the issues were about, which was how to dispose of oil if you nationalize it, because all the tanker trade was owned by the Anglo-Iranian oil company and the Shell and American companies. So there had to be some arrangement, and it was just a hard fact. He simply didn't understand that at all. And he was advised by another engineer, Hasibi, who turned up in my day later on, who was a second-rate oil engineer of NIOC, and he had complete technical sway over the whole proceeding, so it was hopeless. And I won't go into all that, because that was another chapter, and now all this is being revealed now when the records are available. As they are, the 30-year rule now makes it possible. People are now studying that period. Roger Lewis and other people writing works on the subject. So all that's available now to the public. But that was my first connection with Persia. And then, years later, when I was in, British High Commissioner in Cyprus, 1969, the time of Makarios. And Ted Heath came, I remember, on a visit. We talked together, and I'd worked with Ted Heath in the Foreign Office before, head of the European and NATO departments, in trying to get Britain into Europe. So we knew each other very well. And he offered me the job as British ambassador to Tehran. I was only about 50, 51 at the time. And I think one of the reasons why I was offered the job was that the Shah, the time, very interesting, had this strong antipathy to anything Arab. I mean, he loathed Nasser, and he had very deep suspicions of any British who were associated with the Arab world. People who had, more like Anthony Parsons would have been when he was younger, who had been in Bahrain, or who had held positions in the Arab world, particularly in the Gulf. He regarded them as Arab lovers in the Foreign Office, he used to call them, and he wouldn't have them as ambassadors to his country, because he felt they'd be biased in favor of the Arabs. So there were people far better equipped than I was, I knew nothing about the Middle East really, who would have been right for that job as ambassador, but who were debarred in a sense by this attitude of the Shah. So I was very lucky. All my career I've been very lucky, and I think I got that job for that reason.
But before, if you forgive me, I would like to go back to the Mossadegh time, simply because when the attitude, as you say, it was a kind of nationalism that you couldn't understand then, but you probably would understand now in view of what happened since.
Yes.
Around the world.
Oh, yes, there's a nationalism which is in various forms to be found almost anywhere where either direct colonialism, such as in Egypt, Africa, and other places where the British presence was physical, or indirect colonialism, as the Persians always saw it, where the British presence wasn't physical. I mean, Persia has never been colonized as their great race, but they've been invaded successfully throughout the Persian history. And of course, this strong comes out very well in Dennis Wright's book on the Persians in England. Strong feeling of frustration and humiliation that they can't get their act in order because these efficient, strong, smart, self-satisfied rich people are running their country behind those high walls in Ferdowsi Avenue, which wasn't true. It had ceased to be true. It's still believed today, incidentally. You would find highly intelligent Persians who they believe several things at the same time, but half a belief is that for some extraordinary reason the British have been maneuvering Khomeini in ways which will suit the British interests. Why or how, I don't know. They're this fantastic, they're very poetic people and imaginative, and they will invent highly complicated, totally false reasons to support that view that it's the British who still run things behind that high avenue. One of the reasons why we had to open the gates of Ferdowsi Avenue and make the compound visible from the road outside to satisfy that and allay that suspicion.
But at the time of Nasrallah, you really did fight him tooth and nail.
We fought him tooth and nail primarily because we feared at the time, and who can say we were right or wrong, that to have had our oil investment, which is the biggest thing we had, nationalized without proper compensation, would have triggered off a whole series as precedents of similar attempts all around the world.
But it did it not?
And it didn't, because we defeated him in the sense that he was never able to sell that oil.
Yeah, but I mean, for instance, Nasser would not have nationalized the Suez Canal.
I don't think Nasser was, I don't think that made all that difference to Nasser. I think he'd have acted exactly the same way. I doubt whether it, who can say, I don't know. Anyhow, it was the fear, you asked the question, it was the fear of the concern that that might be the case that made us go on. We really offered, from Western point of view, perfectly reasonable terms, which was that we conceded the principle of nationalisation. We had to, anyhow, we had a Labour government then. The principle of nationalisation didn't worry us. He did. We accepted nationalisation. But what we wanted was a practical arrangement whereby the flow of oil for the world, obviously for Britain, but the world generally, the fructification of world trade, which depended on Aberdeen. Kuwait was coming up, admittedly, and if it hadn't been for Kuwait, we would have been in the soup. But it was very much, it was very important. That had to go on. And it wouldn't have gone on unless some arrangement had been arrived at whereby the tankers could take the oil away. We kept on saying to Mr. you can't eat your oil, you can nationalize it, you can do what you like with it, but you can't eat it. You've got to dispose of it. There has to be some arrangement with those who built up this vast network of movement of oil around the world. And we would have accepted, and we offered him a management agreement. That was the scheme, whereby he would nationalize it, have the nationalization, and there would be a management agreement whereby we would run it.
What was his objection?
His objection was that he just did not want anybody from the AIOC around. He offered individual contracts, but nobody would accept them, or particularly wanted them. And he just wanted it out. He wanted, I think, he simply wasn't interested or concerned with the economic factors, which was our sole concern. I've no doubt, and I'm sure I'm right in saying, that the AIOC had been acting as absentee landlords, and although they were meticulously correct in their treatment, I mean, Aberdeen in those days, if you were a Persian working, you were working almost as a servant of the company in your own country. All that were facts of life, if you like. Whether they could have been done differently, and whether the sequence would have been different if they'd been done more tactfully, who knows? I doubt it, because I don't think the Persians, I mean, I think they would have invented a scapegoat which was the AIOC, regardless of circumstances, because of the point you make that it was this feeling of quasi-colonialism, indirect colonialism, born of the frustration with themselves, the fact that they were inefficient, that they had grandiose ideas but couldn't actually run things on their own, whether we were there or not. And I think it didn't matter before the West impinged, because you could live that sort of life in the Persian in the 18th century, 17th century. But I think they felt, and it was the same with Nasser, it was the same with other people, that we brought our own destruction, if you like. We exported to them the picture, the image of Western efficiency, the way things should be run, an economy based on this, that, and the other, and all the Western standards. And they couldn't even manufacture anything. I mean, a factory in Persia at this time, without Western help, didn't work. And I think they were very proud people who had every right to be proud. They were Persia. We were running around in woad in Britain when Persia had a great empire. And they conquered all their invaders and absorbed them, and they had this immense bright pride in their culture and their civilization. And one of the reasons why the Shah fell eventually, I always said that he began importing not just American goods and British goods, he also imported all the vulgarity of the dollar. Because when you export, when a stronger civilization impinges on another, you can see this through Greek history and Roman history too, it's always the ugly, vulgar side that gets absorbed, not always, but often is. Whereas, I mean, I've lived in America, I mean, two-thirds of America is almost Victorian. If you go to the Midwest, the Bible Belt, with these millions of people, all the brashness and the tinsel of the East Coast, the West Coast, gets exported by greedy people who travel. Voyagers and explorers are by nature greedy in that sense, and seldom bring their, apart from sort of the 15th century, Franciscans and Catholics who went and brought the word to the Far East, I bet, but normally the explorers bring greed with them. And that's what the Shah absorbed, and that's what brought him down. And it was those instincts, I think, even at the time of Mossadegh, which were very strong, because the more they came there were. And I felt, I think it was true, probably true at the time I was there with Mossadegh, but I was much too naive and raw and ignorant to notice it, but I'm sure it was true later in my time when I was there with the Shah, that unlike a lot of Muslim countries, the mullahs in Persia, there were a lot of exceptions of course, were genuinely in touch with their villages and with their people. People didn't realize that how much they weren't, as they, some of the Buddhist priests in one or two countries who have all gone corrupt and political and so on. The majority of them were very genuinely representative fathers of their people in their villages. To a large extent they shared it with, of course, the village headmen and other people. And I think they felt strongly that this vulgarity was impinging on that culture. And they were right, to a large extent. And I think that was the seed of what I call the old-fashioned nationalism. And I think that was, a lot of that was felt at the time by the Mossadegh people who supported him. The tragedy was that he was mixed up with negative feelings of humiliation, of revenge, of frustration that they couldn't get back. Like a child who hammers, you know, he can't do anything really. He feels frustrated because the father of the family pervades everything, and he just can't get himself understood, and he can't get anything. There was that feeling very strongly, and made worse, of course, compounded by this, as it went on, by the vulgarity of what they were importing from us.
Another thing that interests, I'm sure it would interest in the future, is that you managed to get this unbelievable blockade going from all around. I mean, when you look at today, that America can't get its partners who really depend on America for their, let's say, defense.
For Libya.
Against Libya. You managed, who were not the biggest power, because the Americans by then were the biggest power already, managed to make everybody just turn against Mossadegh.
I think it was easier in those days. There were only a group of very big oil companies who commanded, on the whole, with their interactions, most of the oil tanker trade we're talking about. One of the main, our main problem was with the Japanese, and there was a famous case which we took to Aden, I think. And Hartley Shawcross did very well. He led all that legal side. And the American companies played along because the last thing they wanted was to have a precedent created with the Mossadegh's nationalization with inadequate compensation, which would interact with their interests in Venezuela and all the other parts of the world. Now it's different. There's so many. I mean, OPEC is only about half of the number of oil countries in the world. It's to start with. Everybody, the individual tanker trades is quite different, I think. But that pattern, the six sisters over there, has broken down, I think. But it was nevertheless remarkable. I'm not sure people thought we'd do it as well as we did do it, the thing I did. And it was rather deceptive because it looked as though sanctions were something that could be made to work, and I never thought it could. And I think that was an exceptional period for the reasons I give. But to come back again, when you took me back to Mossadegh, but the when I came to Persia in 1970, early 71, my knowledge and experience was nil, except for that earlier 2 months that I'd been dealing in 1951. So it was 20 years later, and a lot had happened since
then. That's right. But when finally the blockade worked, and there was the final fiasco, and the Shah went and came back, they say, I don't know anything about it, but they say that, of course, the Shah came back with the help of the Americans and so forth. Was Britain also helpful in restoring the Shah?
Well, I think so. There's an awful lot written on that. Roger Lewis, who just produced a great work on the subject, which will be published soon, has it all, because he's got all the records now. And not very much I could add to that from the record, which won't be in Lewis's book. And Monty Woodhouse has written on it, but he played the part of the time, and a number of people, Willard Dunn and the Rashidian brothers and all those, all that period. So I don't think we can... I had gone by then. I had left for... I went to head of chancery to our delegation in New York with Gavin Jed at the time, so I left all that. I did play a part in inventing the consortium arrangement, which lasted, at least for those who are now reading the minutes I wrote in the Foreign Office in 1952 with Roger Makins, now Lord Sheffield, who was my senior at that time. They say, if I had got that, I suppose I was one of the architects of the original concept of the consortium, which did save us at the end, and we got, I mean, BP as it became, I suppose, retained effectively most of its all it needed really for its trade in another capacity by having that large percentage of the consortium arrangements, which lasted, must have been a good arrangement, it lasted until the Shah's demise. So it lasted 25 years or more, and it was certainly going when I was in Persia, and we had troubles with NIOC and ECBAL and all that, but it worked pretty well. So I had, when I was back in Persia again, I had my experience as head of the oil department, the International Oil Department of the Foreign Office, did stand me in some good stead, I think, with the Shah.
And who was, aside from you, instrumental in the shaping of the consortium from Britain?
Well, I think a lot of... I remember Joe Edison, who lives in my village here in Alston, was the legal advisor then to AIOC, and he had a lot to do with it. And got their names now. The various people who shaped it, and then of course the Americans came in, and a whole crowd of people. But I forgot the details of that. Anyhow, it worked. It was one of those successful things, the consortium. It lasted over 25 years. Anything that lasts 25 years must be good. Well, like NATO. Must be all right.
Yes.
By sheer definition of longevity.
So when you went back to Persia, what did you see that had changed?
Well, I don't know. I hadn't really followed it for 20 years, so I was unable to assess. I came back at a very interesting time, really, because the Shah was, I suppose, at least outwardly, at the very height of his powers in 71, and his oil revenues were probably at their height too, although he always wanted more. And he was very rich and had a lot of money in Persia then, and he hadn't imported inflation to the extent that he did later, which is the tragedy of Persia, by being too greedy and asking too much for the oil prices. Had an enormous amount of wealth to invest in new manufactories and so on. But he, one of the tragedies was that he was going so fast, he was moving too quickly for the Persian people in trying to westernize and industrialize the country. He had these grandiose ideas of Persia becoming the Middle Kingdom, so to speak, and becoming sort of the England, really, of that part of the world, and being the great country between Japan and the West. He had ideas of moving out into the Indian Ocean, which is why he wanted to buy Nimrod, who was our far-reaching aeroplane, why he developed Chabahar. It was actually unnecessary to develop Chabahar, you know, right down on the opposite Oman coast, on the just before, just on the Persian side of Pakistan or the Gulf. Enormous great naval base to be there in Chabahar. All that was stopped, of course, when Khomeini came in. All these grandiose ideas were, in a sense, quite fantastic, but were made possible, at least to conceive, because of the wealth that he had, that was coming into the country. And with the wealth came these adventurers, which are adventurers, rather, I mean, British businessmen, American businessmen, all doing their proper thing, getting money. We tried to, I was one of them. I was one of those who were, I suppose, associated with the sale of the Chieftain tank. It practically balanced Britain's payments. It was such an enormous amount of money we got for it. In fact, we denuded BAOR to let the Shah have all these tanks. I had to find a brigadier, a Rimi from BAOR, from Germany, BAOR, in order to help him make them work. All that was a period, a bewildering period, of building an industry too quickly. And with all those changes, new factories here in Tabriz and everywhere, you were impinging rapidly on an age-old society, a very, very distinguished one. I mean, the Persian society, in its essence, its old culture, more distinguished than anything we produced in Britain, in one sense, in terms of certain values. And this, to impinge on that so quickly in that way. And I think I used to see a lot of Asadullah Alam. We used to have breakfast together in the lovely tree-lined avenue of his house. And I think either he told me that or the Shah told me, because occasionally towards the end of my 2.5 years, I see the Shah quite often, and he occasionally would talk to me with his worries about Persia and the home state. Not that he wanted my advice, but it was someone to talk to. It was rather rhetorical, and he would say, why are my people so ungrateful? This was after, shall we say, some student riots, Tabriz University, that sort of thing. He didn't expect me to tell him that he wanted to, because all around him were yes men. There were no one but yes men. So one did have that opportunity to hear him sometime talk about these problems. And I used to say, or at least I remember saying, Your Majesty, it's the penalty of your own success, and you have to pay that penalty, which is what I meant by this going so quick. And I remember at the end, I did say to him, he never took advice, I don't think, but he was quite a good listener. He was a good listener. Well, I remember saying, I just come back from Chabahar, and I remember being struck by headlines in the local paper. Monarch, this is an English translation, Monarch gives new water supply to such and such a village. It was quite untrue. The monarch didn't know anything about that village, but no credit was given to the local governor of the province or to anybody else like it. Everything went to the monarch. Not even Hervada got any credit for anything. It was always the Shah did this and the Shah did that. And I remember saying to the Shah, I said, that's spending, but if things go wrong, you'll get all the blame, even though you're not responsible for all these things. Wouldn't if I didn't say it quite as bluntly as that, but the gist was, wouldn't it be better just to encourage, because he could do what he liked with the press, encourage the provincial governors, people like that, to get credit for a lot of these things that are being done in this country and spread it. On the theme of it's the penalty of your own success, either he or Asadullah Alam, I can't remember, indicated to me that one of the reasons why he was moving so quickly in this industrialization of his country and modernization, regardless of the social tensions and religious and other factors which were bound to react in one way or other, was that he didn't really trust his eldest son. And that if he'd been the second son, I think he would have trusted him. I think the second son, or the third, had what it takes to be a Shah, had the perhaps strength, ruthlessness, whatever the factors are.
You mean
the younger brother.
Ali Reza, or second brother, was Ali Reza.
Of his son, of the Shah's son.
Our Shah, the Muhammad Reza Shah.
The present, the Shah whom I was talking to.
Yes, but he had only two very small sons, he had no one else.
He had the present Shah, so-called.
That's right, but they were tiny. He couldn't have known.
They weren't tiny. They were about 15. I'm talking about 1973.
But he's only 24 now, so he can't have been that old. I remember because I took...
He was 11 or 12.
About 10, 11.
10 or 11.
10 or 11, but that you can't judge somebody.
10 or 11, well he did, and he regarded you can. I think a father or a mother really can judge at about 11, and how he thought at that time that his son, I think he was 11 or 12, was a rather, he spoilt him ludicrously. He had a great palace with sort of modern toys and conventions and things like that. He thought he wasn't, hadn't got it in him to be in the Shah, and that maybe the younger one might have, who probably was a little bully or something like that. And that was the reason why he was moving so quick in his time. The Shah told me, I think, that it was his intention when he was 65 not to give up altogether, but to recede into the background and give some of the reins over to his son. But he wanted to achieve so much and put everything in order so that when that time came, it would be exactly as he wanted it to be, which is why he was going so quickly, because he was already, 54, 55. The Shah was 2 weeks younger than I was, and he had very little humour, but occasionally he used to react much too quickly, and he would react very strongly if Panorama, one of the BBC Persian programmes, was critical at all of Persia. And they were constantly critical of Persia because they were critical of England or America or anything else, you know, that's how things were. He would never understand that it wasn't the British government, that the Persian service of the BBC wasn't full of anti-Shah people. He would never accept that. Dennis Wright had the same. I no doubt Tony Parton had exactly the same. And I would get rung. I was playing tennis, a message from Asadullah Alam, come at once to the palace, please. I would have to dress up and all go. I get in. The Shah was furious because they just had a transcript of some program, this, that, and the other. And I remember on one particular occasion, well, he was quite unreasonable about the thing. He just had some transcript, I guess, and he was already intimating that he wanted to break off some contract with Britain. You know, he was always threatening retaliation for things that he didn't like and so on. And I remember, I forgot how it went, I remember, we did arrange it actually, it didn't last very long. I remember saying to my friend, another time, would please, first of all, before you react or sack somebody, or he turned out the car, ask for me, I'll come in any time you like, before you do anything. Let me have a chance of seeing whether the transcript is correct to start with. It may be somebody who, from the embassy, like Abshah in London, who was a poisonous chap, don't mind saying that, in the record, you know, doing it on purpose, just to make things difficult. First of all, let us look quietly at the text together and see how serious it is. Then let me investigate and see why this is so, and if it has happened, or it is, or if it really is out there. And then let us discuss it instead of taking action before. And I think on one of those occasions, I think it was my birthday or his birthday, I can't remember. I remember saying, Your Majesty, allow me
I am your senior by 2 weeks. Allow me to say, with respectful advice, Mr. Carolina, a wintry smile came into his face and everything was all right. But one could only do that occasionally, because he didn't respond really to humor and jokes and things of that kind, not very well. It was a pity, because one could have got on so much better if he had. Occasionally.
But it may sound rather idealistic of me to suggest this, but if you knew that he was going too fast or he was going wrong in any way and so forth, was there no way you could have indicated, or was British interest paramount and you said, well, you know, as long as we sell the chief detective?
I think, I regret to say, I think very much the latter. That when I would have these chances, and when I would say it's a penalty of your own success and that sort of thing, or that occasion when I urged him not to have his name attached to everything, but I was speaking entirely on my own as someone who got to know him rather well. I hadn't been there all that long, but I got to know him quite well. But when I was speaking on behalf of the British government, I couldn't do that. And it was only much later, I think Tony...
So when you talk on behalf of the British government, you were saying,
it was the British government, that's right, in the first place, at that time, he was at the height of his power, I think. And I have to mention in a moment, the French doctors, I wasn't supposed to know this, it was a very deep secret, who came out to look at his skin cancer, I think, came just at the time when before I left, and that was the beginning of it. And I think that may have started his internal doubts and debilitations, but I think, I don't know, but when I was there, most of the time I was there, he was at the height of his power, and didn't accept, not even from his own advisers, criticism of what he was doing in the country, wouldn't have accepted it from the British at that time, without resenting it, and taking it out of us in other forms, you very rightly say. Why should we? I mean, the British government's responsibility to the British people was to maximise their interests. That meant the exchequer and the balance of payments and all these things, which for trade with Iran, very valuable. Why risk it by just giving gratuitous advice, if you like, to the Shah, when he might resent it and react accordingly? It wasn't worth their while at that time. It was only much later, towards the end of Tony Parsons' time, when they were urging him to conduct constitutional reforms of that kind. And when I was with the Shah, twice he tried to start an opposition party, which is a ludicrous thing to try to do. And just after when I was leaving, Mehdi Sami, of all people, who's such a splendid man, was asked to... he's well worth talking to, Mehdi Sami. I think he's one of the most sensible persons I know. He may not be a strong personality, he's quiet and all that, but he's about the most sensible. That's around in London today. Balanced, I should say. At least he was. I'm not sure he hasn't gone off a little bit with Bakhtiar and all these people. I don't know. But and poor little Mehdi was asked to start an opposition party, a ludicrous thing. He could run a bank better than anybody, but that wasn't his thing. So all that. We weren't there giving advice to the Shah at all on that. I wouldn't talk around it. I would give advice. I might be Herbeda with Asadullah and some, but not with the Shah. With the others, I give my personal advice. I would put it straight. But with the Shah, by and large, unless I was answering or he was talking to me, I would come, if I had something to say to him, I would say it on instructions. Now, I might have got my own instructions by asking. I said, I propose to say this, that, and the other. Eric Hume was very good and gave me a very free hand, I think. But on the whole, one didn't advise, nor did the American. I had three American ambassadors when I was there. I don't think they would have given that advice. Maybe we should have done, but it wouldn't have been much good. We know.
I wasn't thinking that you should have done it out of the kindness of your heart.
No, I understand that.
At a long-term interest.
Well, maybe we should have done. I think we saw these things and we dealt with them. And I think the way that we did it at all, would have been through those people like Asadullah. I would have done it with Asadullah, hoping that he would have a chance, because see, the Shah really didn't encourage him to advise him too much on these things. He didn't take advice, and at least if he did, he didn't listen to it or want to listen to it. He was a very suspicious man, didn't really trust people. So I never had that. I never had that chance. But any advice I gave to the Shah, which could have saved a situation, as I think it could, I never really proved this, was right at the end of my time, when the oil price hike started. The OPEC price hike started. And it was in two tranches, I think, at the end of the end of 73, the time of the Arab Israel war. They took advantage of it, and the Shah definitely led it, although he pretended he hadn't, to jump up the oil price. And then in January, I think it was, or a month or two later, they jumped it up again, and they quadrupled it, almost quintupled it, and caused very nearly a breakdown of the world economy as a consequence, because we never really since then know what happened. Dollar oil slushed around the world in an enormous amount, and it took all the international banks' wit and strength to manage. It took 3 or 4 years to absorb all that enormous rise in oil prices. We had to have oil rationing and all these things. You remember the consequences. A number of countries were nearly ruined through it. And of course the Shah and the other, Persia and other countries got an enormous amount, quadruple revenues all at once. It was very nice for them. But the disaster, as we know, was twofold. One, generally, that all he succeeded in doing, was the main point, really, all he succeeded in doing was to create inflation for the first time in Persia, because he was importing goods. This policy of getting rich quick, of accelerating the industrialization of Persia, the modernity of Persia, which we just talked about, that policy was just beginning. Therefore he had to spend large sums, all this money he had acquired, which he was quite able to do with this new money, in importing. But what he was importing was also doubling, trebling in price, because he forced that on the world. So he was importing his own inflation, and he started a very large, after I left, this was happening, heavy and large and growing inflation, which was beginning to upset very much the bazaar, on which, as you know, from Rustic's days onwards and many years before, the power of the Shahs, of the regime, had depended, with other factors, the mullahs and church and so on, and they started turning against him. The people who had been his supporters really before had grave doubts now about their future, because they were worried, they weren't used to this sudden surge of inflation of the middle class there. And it probably was one of the factors that brought him down to his own acts. It's rather like a Greek play, you know, very much like a Greek play. You could find parallels in Aeschylus with all that happened to the Shah, if you read it, somebody tried to analyze and write a book on it. And that was one factor that he did at the time. But I nearly, it sounds rather arrogant, and I think it is arrogant, and I don't think it really, if you look at the records, it wouldn't look like this. But I nearly stopped it. If I'd had American support, we might have, because at that time, I was seeing a lot of the Shah, and Dick Helms, who was newly arrived, he had been head of the CIA, he was a newly arrived ambassador, became a great friend of mine, still is, had only just arrived. Of course, Americans had more power than we had in this sort of thing. But the State Department were still very hesitant because of the Sherman Act, because of the antitrust acts in America, in giving instructions, so to speak, to their oil companies. They kept away from that. We were less, particularly the British government had a share in BP, but we were less inhibited. We didn't have a Sherman Act, so we could give advice at least to them and discuss these things more closely. That was one inhibition that Helms suffered from also, and he was new, and I suppose the Shah hadn't known him so well. And so he never got the instructions I wanted him to get, but what I wanted him to get was instructions that I got for myself, which was to go to the Shah. The Shah had been arguing with me I must hike the prices up, because it's the only way in which I can match the inflation in other countries, and also it's the only way in which I can find the right level for the price of our oil, which should be the equivalent, and he had a whole packet, a basket of prices based on coal prices elsewhere to justify the increase in prices for himself and all that. And I said to the Shah, and he got instructions, look, if we can't dissuade you from doing this, at least to the level you're doing this, at least consider that you'd be much better off, instead of doing it now, he did it twice, do it over 4 years, spread your price over 4 years, it'll be better for you, you won't be importing inflation at the rate you will be importing inflation, you won't damage the whole economic structure of the world, the Western world, which is what you're about to do, which we told him, we warned him about, and you would be far more statesmanlike, and so on. And he didn't listen. And I maintain this is one of the ifs of history. And I may be quite wrong, although one has these fanciful ideas at my age, looking back without the records, that if I'd got Dick Helms to get the same instructions, if the American hadn't been inhibited by these other factors, Sherman and so on, and we'd gone in together very, very strongly, I don't see why we shouldn't adopt the Shah. He said, I can't, he's gone too far, it's not just me, it's OPEC and Algeria, Venezuela and so on, but I think he could have done. And we would have changed the whole of the economic history of the 1970s.
First of all, was it simply the Sherman Act prevented the Americans from giving, or were they just simply difficult to persuade?
I don't know, I'm not sure, I don't think we even tried to persuade them. I don't remember our Treasury doing very much. It all went so quickly, this. But looking back on it, there may be other factors. Looking back on it, I can't see why, if we really lined up together, could it make sense? Because he wanted the money quick. He pledged himself to OPEC and all that.
Now, when you say that he confronted you with a set of facts and figures and that kind of thing.
They were very clever.
And they were clever, as you say. Well, somebody must have prepared those, because, I mean, he wasn't an economist, he wasn't a petrol expert. Somebody must have helped him. Must have
Hervada, advisors. Hervada would have helped him, because Hervada had been grown up, you see, in IPC and in NIOC, and he knew about oil. It wasn't very difficult.
Did you put your project to him?
No, entirely with the Shah. That I should have known, because Hervada wasn't in budget. I don't know who helped him. The Shah was perfect. The Shah did his own negotiations with the consortium for many years. He was an expert on it. The Shah, they would come to St. Moritz if he was there, or to Geneva or somewhere, negotiate. People like Page, who was the head of Esso, one of the ablest negotiators I've ever met, head of one of the biggest oil company in the world. They would come and have lunch with me or something after. I mean, the Shah, with every match, was a match for these people. He understood, he knew the detail. One of my last things before I left, we were dealing with these little gas mounds, where you get gas out of the ground rather than oil, as a complicated negotiation. The Shah did it single-handed. He may have had Iqbal with him, but Iqbal didn't know anything like what the Shah did. The Shah was a remarkable man. He had almost total recall, personal recall. He worked 12 hours a day. He was quite extraordinary man in that sense. Unbalanced in many respects and so on, but I mean, in terms of knowledge, when I was doing the chieftain tank arrangement agreements with the Shah, I'm hopeless at this sort of thing, can't remember any detail, and he used to hadn't been there very long, and the Shah would call me out, have me up there, and we'd go through this, and there were the great big red books with all the details of the chieftain tank thing like that. And he read all the small print, and one absolute disaster was that the specifications that had originally been made before my time, I suppose Lieutenant Wright, and his day, not him, there were some factors there allowing for the tank to operate in the very hot deserts of the south, which weren't built into the tanks that we had in BOR and so on. It was a highly complicated electrical machinery. He discovered somewhere there that we hadn't made this specification, we hadn't made the allowance for it, and he practically blew up or cancelled the thing. But I had the experts with me. I've got his name now. He became a knight. Somebody knighted him for his efforts. The head of the Ministry of Defence sales side, who had come out, all his experts there, and they hadn't spotted this. And the Shah could talk to them all. See them all. And he used to. I remember one day I arrived, and he would say to me, an ambassador, he'd say, tell me, what is the sprocket horsepower of the chieftain tank? I didn't have even heard of a sprocket horse barn, you see. And by this time I was wiser, and I would say, Your Majesty, you know I'm hopeless at these things, you tell me. He liked that. He liked that, because that's what he really wanted, to show off, you see, his knowledge of all these things. So I always did that with him. I never tried to, argue. But he had that extraordinary power. He was his own commander-in-chief. I remember very well, at the 1973, was it? We had the Shah over to London. I must tell you the story of how I got the Queen to invite him to Windsor Castle and what happened. It's a very interesting story. But the Shah came over to London. I think it was during that time. I came over, of course, to Peter Carrington as Minister of Defence. And we sat in the bowels of the Admiralty. You know that big underneath the Admiralty there. And all the top secret things were flashed onto the screen. The latest Jaguar... some turret and some other things. I had all these things. It was like a man shopping at Harrods. He just sat there, you know, and said, I think I'll have one of those, or one of those. Okay, we were 5 feet. It's all we wanted to do. Well, the naughty man, I suppose. Well, not naughty, I mean, it's silly to say, but I mean, all we were really concerned about was selling our arms, like the French and everywhere elsewhere, to a very rich man who bought them up, even though we knew he probably couldn't use them properly because the army wasn't sufficiently efficient to use these highly sophisticated weapons and things like that. But then we'd have a training team that would go out. Americans did it on a much larger scale with the Air Force. They had a monopoly, practically, with the personnel. But the Shah knew what he was about. He didn't have someone over his shoulder telling him to minister. I don't think he brought anyone with him, I don't remember. He knew. He was expert on these things. On the Navy, the Shah took precautions. Every few years, he sacked the top four admirals of the Persian Navy in order to gain control, and he was ruthless. He behaved very badly to them, but he did it on purpose, so that there should never be a revolt. Later on, you see, you know, the admiral who tried to take over power later on wasn't the one. After Khomeini, I think it was some admiral who yeah, it was always probably the Navy who was the most restless elements there, often is.
Are you thinking of Admiral Madani?
Probably, yes. And but I mean, I'm only mentioning that because I think the Shah had a particular suspicion. He must have had, because every few years he got rid of Rafai, or whoever it was. Was it Rafai, head of the Navy? That's a nice chap, who arrived one day and found a chap at his desk and a taxi to take him away. It's that sort of thing which the Shah thought guaranteed him loyalty and total command. I don't think he minded so. I don't think he was so concerned with the army, because I think he had people at the top there. Just as he had Nasiri, who was his own comrade from the past. About six people he really trusted, only six, if that. Sharpur, a reporter, because he played with him as a boy, you know, and his father.
Sharpur,
you know. Do I mean Sharpur? Yes, Sharpur. Reporter, you know, so somebody reported.
Oh, yes.
Sharpur reporter.
Who was at the press office in London.
No, he was...
Sharpurian, wasn't he?
No, Sharpur reporter. We made him a knight, God knows why. He was the right-hand man of the Shah throughout the whole of these proceedings when I was there. You never heard of Sharpur? I mean, do I mean Sharpur? Yes. Reporter, his name was. His father was a reporter was a Parsi, Zoroastrian. His father was a reporter. He trusted him. Asadullah Alam, he trusted again because of the childhood reasons they brought up together. Ekbal, who stuck by him through thick and thin, he trusted. And Nasiri, maybe one or two others. But those are the only people he actually trusted, as far as he could trust anybody. So he trusted, I think, Savak and the army. He had someone he trusted there. The Navy he didn't very much. The Air Force was under his own son-in-law, of course. He was Fatima had married head of the Air Force.
Brother-in-law.
Otherwise, and he knew all the detail. And he was a very good pilot himself. When I sold the Concorde, I sold the two options of the Concorde to the Shah. He took the controls himself, the Shah, and flew down through the Persian Gulf.
Okay. So you flew to the south?
We flew to the south. This was, when I say I sell the Concorde, I should say, I mean, this was the process in which we, the British government, did sell three options of the Concorde to the Shah. We had the money. Well, with Heseltine, we flew to the south with the Shah. The Shah's brother was on board. Ali, what's his name? His older brother. Forgot his name.
The Shah's brother?
Brother. Who did the? He was the great, you know, the great shot. He shot all wild animals, and he was the.
Prince
Ali Reza.
Abdur Reza.
Abdur Reza was on board, and Ghulam Reza, I think, and myself, and Heseltine, of course, who come out with the Concorde. The first time, I think, the Concorde had flown a prototype as far as Persia, the Shah to see. So we left that wonderful airport, the Shah built for himself, with a little pavilion, which is the Royal Pavilion, and off we went. Who just died now, the pilot, what's his name, Marvis man, who was the pilot, handed the controls over to the Shah, who was a good pilot himself, and he flew at Mach 2, or whatever it was, or beyond the speed of sound, he quite pleased. So we had to start turning to come back, almost before we got to the Persian Gulf, it was going so quickly. And we came back and we landed at Trumshaw, it was Marvis man. Trumshaw just died. Great big fellow, like wrapped up in a Union Jack, he couldn't have been more English. And we arrived back again. And we got out and we went to the Royal Pavilion. There were the journalists, you see, and Persian journalists, very dutiful, they had to be. And the Shah was used to this sort of question. Did you enjoy your flight, Your Majesty? Yes, it was very enjoyable. Would you like to fly again? Well, I would like to fly again, that sort of thing. What the Shah had forgotten, and I perhaps hadn't told him, there were two British journalists out there. One was the Times correspondent, who did the unthinkable thing. He put his thing up and said, Your Majesty, do you intend to buy the Concorde? And the Shah was so surprised, he said yes. And that's how we sold three options to the Shah.
And why was, you said something about Heseltine behaving badly, in what way?
No, he didn't. I mean, I thought he was very arrogant as far as I was concerned, that's all. I expect ministers, especially junior ministers, to treat a senior ambassador rather better than he did. I think he was quite unaware of doing that. It was just my impression at the time, confirmed by recent events in January 1986.
What about, you said, I must tell you the story of how you got the Shah to come here and to go
to Windsor, yes. Would you like me to do that now or after that?
No.
You probably exhausted my repertoire, I don't know. But this was a different story, and a much longer one, so we may not take it on the tape. That in 73, one of the policy changes of the British government at the time was a retreat from east to Suez. And it had been begun earlier on, but we were no longer, we'd been declining in power ever since Suez itself in 56, and had to give up our Indian Ocean fleet and had to withdraw from Aden and whole factors. And now the time had come where we could no longer felt that we could have responsibility, defense responsibility, for the crucial states and for all our little shakedom that we were responsible for. And we wanted to convert that relationship into one of treaties of association and friendship and so on, and not of defense. Which meant, really, that the defense, the power that would defend the Gulf, Persian Gulf, would no longer be in British hands. And the Shah, who exaggerated everything, was particularly concerned that his lifeline for his oil, which was his lifeblood, going down through the Gulf, wouldn't be at the mercy of Iraq, or even right down at the Straits of Hormuz, where it narrows there, anyone could hold him to ransom there. And I remember he used to argue with me, for example, the Israelis, I think, the year before, with a bazooka, had held something to ransom on some island or something or other, and he said anybody with bazookas in one of the islands in the middle of the Gulf could hold us to ransom and all that, and I must have control when you give up, hand over to the crucial states and make the United Emir Republic, United Emirate Republics, UAR, URE, what's it? UAR, I forgot what it is now. I ought to know because I had a hand in the whole thing. When you do that, you must make sure that I must be certain that I can control and my own defenses down there, the Gulf. Jabba Howe's all right, but what happens further on? There were two islands in the middle there. One called Abu Musa. Abu Musa, there was a. And the Tuns. Abu Musa was an island off the sheikhdom of Sharjah, almost in the middle of the Gulf. And the Tums, the greater Tums, the lesser Tums, further down, also almost in the middle of the Gulf. As I say, Abu Musa Island was quite a biggish island, belonged to the Sheikh of Sharjah, The two tombs belong to the Sheikh of Ras Al Khaimah. Never ever heard of him, but he's now part of the Abu Dhabi in Dubai, you know, all that. And on the lesser tombs, there was practically empty, nothing at all. They were just rocks, really. On the larger tombs, there was a lighthouse and a few Indians, sweltering about 120 in the shade, and a lot of snakes. That was all it was. And they belonged to the Sheikh of Ras Al Khaimah. And the British were responsible for the defense on his behalf. We held that position, one of our defense treaties. So the time was coming when we were announcing we were going to withdraw. And the Shah wanted to make sure that he held that control. And all the maps, which had been drawn, of course, in the past by people from the Indian Army up there, the Admiralty, were all British maps. And they showed that these islands belonged to Sharjah and Ras Al Khaimah. The Shah disputed that and said they really belonged to his ancestors or somebody's ancestors and so on, which is not true. But he had no proof. So the problem was what we were going to do about these islands when we withdrew, because the Shah would have then gone to war and had to lose the troops. A lot of people had been killed and we'd have been responsible as usual and that sort of thing. Finally, the outcome was we had endless negotiations with the Shah. He used to make us go all the way up to his palace in the Caspian to do these negotiations. On and on and on, threatening all the other way, you know, that he'd cut off this contract and this, that, and the other. Finally, not long, but the day before, I can't remember exactly, we were due to leave. The treaties of defense were going to be converted to treaties of association. On instructions, this is what we may have devised them for ourselves, on instructions. I went to see the Shah, and rather casually, talking about other things, told him, 24 hours, he didn't know, nobody knew when this was, I told him, I gave him 24 hours before we were going to actually move out. Although I think officially we may have blurred the issue and said it would be later. And that was enough. And the next day, he sent his Shafiq's son, who was assassinated, I think, later on. He sent him down with some of the hovercraft, which we'd sold him, incidentally, and took Abu Musa and the two tombs and landed their men, and he rewarded all the admirals with men. Well, I think one Indian was killed or something like that. Everyone was rewarded, great victory, terrific things like that. It was all done, and we always pretended to look surprised that the Shah had done this, but it was all, that was how we solved it. And the Sheikh of Ras Al Khaimah was terribly upset, and we said, I'm terribly sorry, this could have happened, and all that sort of thing. It was all slightly, and it wasn't very honest, but it was any way we could solve the thing. So it was solved like that. And we thought that was it. Fine, we've solved this thing. We'd really occupied a lot of my time. But, not a bit of it. Then, not very long after, Iraq, I think it was, was incensed by all that had gone on, you see, summoned Iran to the Security Council with a case against Iran. And the Shah suspected that we were behind it. When everything went wrong, we were behind it, thought that somehow we were behind this. And everything was going wrong again, and our relations were going to go bad again. Then I had the bright idea, I think it was me, anyone can remember these things. I threw Alec Hume. We asked the Queen if she would invite the Shah and the Shahbanu to come and spend Ascot weekend with them at Windsor. And they did. Now this was something which neither the Kremlin, nor the Elysee, nor the White House could conceivably do. They could not have even, they couldn't do this. Only the Queen could do this. The Shah was in seventh heaven. He rode down Ascot, an open carriage, that lovely thing with all the crowds cheering, with the Shahbanu and the Queen on his side. He had a marvellous time, hairy with pleasure, forgot about his music, things like that. Everything was marvellous. The Queen, I wrote and thanked her because it was such a sacrifice, because Ascot weekend is very important for the Queen when she has all her family there and they play charades and family games and all that and go riding. But then she had to sacrifice a lot of that because he's not the most amusing of men, you know, and she had to do all that. And she did it. And she did it for the national cause, and it made all the difference. This is one justification for the royal family, at least with their castles and things that nobody knows about. And during that evening, we had this big dinner beforehand where everything was produced. I mean, the silver that hadn't been seen on Windsor Castle table, Everyone was there. Every member of the royal family except Snowden was there. Queen Mother, Charles, everybody. And Francis and me. And all the members, you know, their special uniform they wear, very smart. And after dinner, we always rather late, by this it was marvelous dinner. Afterward, the Queen took us round the apartments, which are not even shown to the private viewers, and which the Queen's librarian had got out specially with cases with examples of Persian manuscripts, which hadn't seen the light of day for a long time, far better than anything the Shah had or the British Museum. You know, the Queen has all these marvellous things of the past. And the Shah, the Charbonnet, you know, that great work of the 12th century. The Shahnameh.
The Book of Kings.
Book of Kings, which she had some pages of and all that. We wandered around, just the royal family chatting with Princess Margaret, making amusing remarks to the Shah about it, showing examples of her sister's baby handwriting. All that sort of thing went on, you see. And about midnight or later, the Queen beckoned me and said, the Shah, the plan is that he and I should go riding in Windsor Park tomorrow morning before we go and to Ascot, that he and I are riding, and she goes off with her father and all that other thing. Can you give me some advice? Well, unlike Dennis Wright, I'm not a rider. I've never used to ride with the Shah, but I did remember, I said, man, the Shah, like many Persian men, will really ought to ride a stallion. A Persian man is not their dignity to ride a gelding or mare, and they must ride stallions. That's the dignity of the Persian. It doesn't apply in England, though, but that's how it is. Oh, the Queen said, no, that's very awkward. I don't have a stallion in my stable. Then she said, yes, but Anne, her daughter, Anne has a stallion, and I think we'll be able to mount him for the Shah. And then she said, with a twinkle in her eye, there's this one problem now. I hope that doesn't matter, she said. The stallion's name is Cossack, because the Shah's father was a Cossack. And she knew she made him. So I said, I don't think perhaps you won't have to mention it, ma'am, I said. And that's how, and they did, they went riding the next morning. And I wrote to thank her. It was a great, really big sacrifice she made.
Did she tell you what they talked about as they went riding?
No, but she had, I talked to the Queen on a number of occasions about the Shah, you know, because she came to Tehran once when I was there, and so we talked about it. And she meets him, she'd met him several times before then, not only on funerals, you know, royal funerals he'd been to. He is just, she finds him an immensely boring man, she found him, because he had no small talk, you see. He doesn't want to talk about new factories in Cameron or something all the time. She found him very boring. Well, boring, but not, I mean, he's not a man for a woman to talk to like that. Not for a long time, I mean, half an hour is very interesting. She can learn in half an hour all she wishes to know, or has need to know about what the population rise is and what they're doing with this and the other, you know. So there was nothing beyond that. And that's as far as I know.
Take two, still the 21st of January 1986, with Sir Peter Ramsbottom. This is the continuation of his time in Iran, and here we go. Now, what I'd like to ask is, when you were called back to England only after 2.5 years, what did you do then? Did you go and see the Shah?
When I was called back to England, I was offered the post of British ambassador to the United States.
Yes.
Which is why I left Persia. And the Shah, obviously, wasn't very pleased with my going after a relatively short time. I think that thought of his was compensated by, he was rather flattered that the British ambassador to his country was going as ambassador to the United States. Mm-hmm. He always thought in terms of comparisons with Iran and so on. And so that was a way of conveying to him that the British had thought very highly because they were pointing Ramsbottom to America, and therefore they must have sent and all that. Mm-hmm. So he didn't mind too much for that reason. And I went, and there were several occasions when I said goodbye. I think probably it was on those, one of those last occasions when we did talk about a little bit I mentioned before about his future a little bit, and why when I made the remark that perhaps it would be a good thing that he shouldn't take all the credit for everything, mm-hmm. and allow other people to do so. But I'd and then I could very nice, and he received me especially and gave me I think one of the first of its kind, a new type of coloured photograph. It looks like a portrait, which he and he and the Charbonneau had, and they both inscribed it for me and so on.
Did, another thing, although you say that it's in Roger Lewis's book and everything, but of course books are different from this work, yes. of oral history. And I believe that there was a documentary a little while ago on the BBC called Fall of an Empire.
That's right, yes, I was on that.
And you were on that, and apparently very, very good too. I was told by friends who'd seen it. Unfortunately, I hadn't seen it. And you did talk at length about the demise of Mossadegh and the coming back of the Shah.
The coming back of the Shah I knew very little about, because it happened really after my time, and I'd already gone off, was going off to New York on a new post. I had very little to do with the plans for undermining Mossadegh at the end and bringing the Shah back. And my time really ended, it started before Mossadegh, when we hoped that Ras Mara would become, was Prime Minister, would be able to put the supplementary agreement through the Majlis, but failed, and he was assassinated. I really started about there, and I ended my time as head of the Iraqi desk and the oil desk in the Foreign Office just when the consortium was coming about to be fashioned, and the sanctions against the Iranian oil were completed just about that time. So I know a little, I can't answer questions about the Rashidian brothers and anything like that.
Well, what did you talk about in the film?
So on the film we talked about Mossadegh and the negotiations that failed with Mossadegh and why they failed, and could we have done that, and did the Americans put pressure on us, and all those sort of things.
Did they?
Element. Not directly, not while I was out in Iran. On the whole, they were very reasonable. I think they wished us to have made further concessions at that time. As it turned out, they were wrong, but I don't think it was because that we were right at that time. It just so happened things worked that way. And when the Eisenhower regime came in, they supported us more fully on that question. But I think the Americans, we made a lot of mistakes, I think. Largely, it was difficult for us not to go on backing the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company throughout, not only because there was a government share in it, because it did represent our largest interests. So we were tied to a certain extent by what Willie Fraser, who was then Lord Fraser, I think, did. Which was a handicap to us. I think we made some mistakes on reflection in insisting too much on the legal niceties of the recognition of expropriation and the degree of compensation and those things. I think we could have managed it more easily. I don't think it would have done us any good, because I think Mossadegh had become the prisoner of his own extremism by then. He went around in terror of his life most of the time then. Because he had, rather like Frankenstein, he created this Frankenstein emotionally of nationalism, which, as you rightly term it, and we agreed earlier on, was there, endemic in the Persian people, born of their humiliations and frustrations and fantasies. And he gave birth to all that, but both on the extreme right, the National Front, it was called, and the Tudeh Party, the Communists, and he unbottled them, so to speak. And he became a prisoner, really, of that extremism. And he had no room for maneuver. At the time we were negotiating with him on the Stokes mission in August 51, even if we agreed almost to everything, he'd insisted, he still couldn't have agreed, I don't think. And there was an Ayatollah Kashani at the time, who was similar, really, to Khomeini today, who could have taken over very easily.
And was he, as they said, at the time, one heard that because the British-controlled clergy was Kashani in relation...
We didn't control the clergy, which we had done. One thing we couldn't control, I think, was that we didn't control very much by then. These were all the myths of earlier influence, British influence, probably before the First World War. Certainly, when we sacked Wesershaft and there onwards, from the days of Vera Bullard, we didn't have much control of influence. I mean, I imagine other countries had just as much influence. Mm-hmm. The Israeli intelligence service was much better informed than ours of what was going on in Iran. Mm-hmm.
So Khashoggi wasn't
connected.
Oh, at all.
Absolutely none at all. He was a wordy to us. We had no idea what he was up to.
What about Khomeini? Everybody believes Khomeini is pro-British.
I didn't think we had any touch with Khomeini. We didn't even know. I mean, I was, as a British ambassador, unlike perhaps the American ambassador, the British ambassador controls the Secret Service. I wouldn't have had it otherwise. You can't have another arm of power of your government operating unknown to you. So British ambassador is in charge of the Secret Service. When I say in charge of, they have their own instructions from London. Mm-hmm. But no major move, and he's not talking about individual operations, I guess, but no major move of political kind which could impinge on what he's responsible for, which is all policy matters and things, that could take place without his approval. And the whole time that I was there, I don't know about Tony Parsons any day, I hardly heard of Khomeini. He really left, he was living in Iraq. He counted for nothing. In religious circles, people paid attention to him, but in terms of power, such as I was meant to be concerned with, factors in Iran, he was unimportant at that time. And certainly we had no contacts with him. But whether or not later on things changed, I don't know. I very much doubt it.
But
you want to ask, Tony Parsons didn't mention that at all.
Yes, he did. He denied also that they had anything to do with it.
Yes, but I mean, he would tell the truth.
Absolutely. But what about, you mentioned...
I wish we could. We don't have that sort of power. I mean, you're people who think like that attribute far greater devious and power and intelligence and skill to the British Intelligence Service than they have. Perhaps more than that. I mean, I don't think any diplomats are ever skillful nowadays can do that sort of thing.
So when you say that you also had under your supervision or under your jurisdiction also the intelligence service, British intelligence service operating in Iran, but the Americans didn't, that means that they were totally independent.
No, I think that used to be the case. I think it had been vastly improved. I can't swear to that, but I think that the CIA used to have, probably changing that, I think it's less now, at times, a much more independent link. It depended on how powerful the head of the CIA was. Mm. I suspect that in Dulles' day, the other Dulles' day, it was much more independent and powerful in ambassador. I think it had been shifting and changing during my day. But I don't think it had quite the same, it was so powerful. I mean, the CIA headquarters in London, the monies they had, just dwarfed anything that MI6 could ever have hoped to have had. Secondly, MI6 at the top came under the Foreign Office anyhow. I mean, there was somebody alongside them all the time from the Foreign Office. I don't think that was true of the State Department, the CIA. Mm-hmm. They had the liaison officers, but not the same.
And what was the role of the British intelligence service in Iran?
Well, primarily the value to it was liaison with Sadak.
About what, though?
About all the threats in the Middle East, the possibility of communist uprisings, all that sort of thing.
Oh, I see. It was in relation to sort of more general things.
Exchanges of information, Russia and matters of general interest. Obviously, Sabat wasn't going to tell us too much about the things that wasn't in Shah's interest for us to know. We had to find it out for ourselves if we wanted to know. So we would operate as far as we could independently of Sabat. But a good deal of a lot of the valuable information came from Sabat, and they got a lot of valuable for us, for instance. I would myself use MI6 reports to tell the Shah something about what was going on in Iraq, which was dangerous to Iran.
I see, because at the time you were sort of backing Iran against Iraq?
Not necessarily. Maybe we'd have told the Iraqis something that was useful to them to know about Iran. I don't know. It depends. It depends what's valuable to the country.
Yes.
It's valuable to know. Like Khrushchev spent his suggestion to Eisenhower that they should exchange spies. The most sensible suggestion ever made.
I mean, what would be the purpose of it?
But then they wouldn't be so frightened of each other. And the sort of imagination that in his local life in Persia that the British are behind Khomeini and all that would be less fears which are born of of imagination and fright and so on, but the fears I get, they are the worst counsellors. Fear is the worst counsellor, both for individuals and for nations. And wars are started more for misjudged appreciations born of fear than anything else in the history. So one major thing that is valuable for an ambassador who is there to keep peace for his own country's sake and can do is to allay fears as far as possible. If he does that successfully, he's a very good ambassador. One of the ways to allay his fears is to remove the cause of the fear and assure and give assurances which can be believed that the facts, suspected facts, are not true.
When the in 1953 it was alleged, and one doesn't know what the truth is behind it, that the CIA sort of connived to bring the Shah back 3 days after he had left the country and overthrown Mossad Beg and so on, and spent a lot of money. What was the role of the British in that particular coup, if there was such a
I've forgotten now. I think I rather think Monty Woodhouse writes all about it in his book, I think. I haven't read. It's all in there. I rather think that we were much responsible, through the Rashidian brothers, I'm told, for having set the thing up, the undermining of Mossadegh. One time we were wanting, before Zahidi came forward, we wanted that other Ghulam Ghulam, what could you name now? QU something other, we wanted him to succeed to take over, but of course he did, and he failed. And I think a lot of the trio for setting it all up and arranging it all was done by MI6's contacts. I don't think the CIA had the very good ones. And then Archie Roosevelt, who was brilliant in his own way, came and supplemented all that, and I think it was a rather a joint operation towards the end, but the Americans put it probably who clout in with their money and things like that, and maybe the British had contributed on the, with all the ingredients, you see.
And on the intelligence side,
well, both, I think they both probably operated together. But I think that's not badly documented. I wasn't there, but I think that most of that is in Monty Woodhouse's story. And the Shah came back. I think he would have come back anyhow. I think he just played for them. The Shah changed, of course. I mean, I think he was sobered up when his first of his attempted assassinations sobered him up enormously. He used to be a playboy, rather, and going to the nightclubs. I remember John Russell, Sir John Russell, was there, became married as well, and he was counselor there, I think, as late as the 60s or early 60s. They used to go out to nightclubs with the Shah about and all that. And then he sobered up. And then on the picnic occasion, was one of his Praetorian guard tried to shoot him, and I think the bullet went through his cheek and down the other side and all that. And then thereafter, he thought he was possessed by some divinity. Which is a very dangerous thing to have. Macarius thought the same, but it was equally dangerous, because he had a miraculous escape, and I was there as British High Commissioner. It was very bad for him, but he then thought that he was inviolate and had this divine will and so on. The Shah, curiously, the Shah, although he went rather perfunctorily, it was not enough to attend Muslim prayers and visit and go and visit Muslim sites and mosques. I don't think he was a Mohammedan heart. He had these fantasies, he had these ideas, I think, about Zoroastrianism. In fact, I'm Tony Parsons telling me, I think that since my day, he tried to chase the calendar, I think, back to the Zoroastrian one. And when we were there in the 1972, there was this, I remember he went and communed with the bones of his so-called ancestors. They weren't his ancestors at all, of course, but Cyrus the Great and all that at Pasargadae. And he would commune with the bones. It was very Wagnerian, the whole thing. And you heard you sort of got a demoralizing atmosphere that he conjured up, rather unhealthy. And I think he had, in Asadullah told me, he had rather like Socrates, had this daimon on his shoulder, you know, who would caution him. I think the Shah actually, I think he did believe he had his daimon. of fate. It was, as I say, all about the Wagnerian type of attitude, mixed up with Zoroastrianism. It wasn't at all healthy, I don't think. But it did get him through, and he felt fated, and that he was being preserved for these great works in the world. And I think that was a very different Shah, certainly to the one when we went out with Mossadegh, for the Mossadegh thing in 51, when he was a timid, cautious, not very nice, not a very nice person. And then, rather frightened. And of course, anybody who'd be brought up like that by Reza Shah would have been. We really got to see those photographs of this young man, rather chinless man in a peak cap, sitting, standing beside this enormous fellow in an army coat, Reza Shah, on some railway going through to the Caspian. And they used to go around together. He was to be terrified of this father, who was exacting so much from him. Very difficult for a child. And that, and the mixture of La Rose in Switzerland, must have been a very awkward combination to grow up with, I think. And I think it told throughout his life. And he had this mixture of bravery, in a way. I mean, he was a lonely person, he didn't very much work for his country, with ruthlessness and a streak of cruelty, which is a sign of weakness in him all his life. But I think, I still think that it was when the French doctors came out, for the first, I think it was skin cancer that he had then. And also, I think they came to treat his mother, who was very ill. And I think from then onwards, he gradually, I suspect, gradually lost confidence in himself as the cancer got worse from there. But it was only a skin cancer, I don't think it was a serious one, but I think it troubled him a lot.
You said something about it is about time that somebody rehabilitate the Shah, apart from the fact that, of course, events have so far rehabilitated his reign, because what has happened since is just so horrendous that...
There's quite a comparison.
There's no comparison. But you meant that personally somebody ought to rehabilitate him. What do you mean?
Again, these are comparisons, but if you compare this Shah with some of the 19th century Shahs, I mean, there was a man who really was trying a mission for his country. Nobody else tried before. I'm sure he lined his own nest, everybody did, in their own way, the Pahlavi Foundation and all that. The Sharpur report are getting his cut off all the time, all those things. Of course they did, but he did work 12 hours a day, not many people did. He denied himself a lot of the relaxation. And although you can't believe half you read in Mission for My Country, I mean, I've my own witness, how you go around in the Education Corps and the Health Corps, they did a lot. The standard of living in villages was greatly improved, the literacy rate was greatly improved, the cooperatives, and he really tried his agricultural cooperatives, or rather on Nancy Lambton's lines and things. He tried these things. I mean, he was interested, he would have experts in to bring these things to his country. He wanted better roads. He did get more. There a lot of it was Folie de Grandeur too. But at the time, you wouldn't have many. I mean, apart from the students abroad, I mean, most Persians were secretly rather pleased. They're like criticizing him. They're rather pleased what he'd done. Not many people can actually do that. You look around absolute rulers anywhere today, you find how many achieve what he achieved, is all I'm saying. Right, he, Sabak and all that, lamentable. Now, what annoys me, it was true of this end of empire program, it's so unhistorical. It always annoys me so much. They start importing judgments from 1985 from Britain on what was going on in these early days, like 20-something years before. Change has been enormous since then in a country which can't be compared with Britain. They don't have an established civil service going back 300 years. They have civil servants don't owe their loyalties yet. They take if ever they do. They don't have a police force we've had for 900 years with their sort of traditions. Why not? Because they don't have a country. I mean, we don't have a country which is beset with tribes, Bakhtia and Khatak tribes, with Turks, with Kurds, with threats from everybody. For 2,000 years they've been threatened and invaded. With the Iraqis training saboteurs, as they were the border and in Lebanon and places like that. We don't have a country like that. What do you do to hold it together? You have to be ruthless. The only thing you compare Sabak with would be the Star Chamber in Elizabethan times in Britain, where exactly the same cruelties were performed. That was about the level you should compare with historically. Several of which we start judging it as though time is at the same level. I get very annoyed by this because people do not understand that countries are separated as much by time as by space. They understand space. That's easy. They don't understand. They are separated by time. And therefore judgment. You won't make a judgment on space. Why should you make a judgment in time? Because you cannot judge another country's development as at the same time speed as your own. Maybe more, maybe less. And we're doing it all the time. And I don't even read histories or journalists or anybody who write like that. It's totally unhistorical. And meaningless, really. And that is, when you ask me about rehabilitating, that is what's happening to the Shah. He's being judged on the wrong timescale. Not only the wrong timescale, but not taking into account the conditions in which he had to operate. And anyone would have had to operate. And if you'd sent Attlee or someone to be Shah at that time, somebody who wrote that, he'd have had the same problem, he'd have had to resort to the same method, or get out. In my judgment.
Now, let us go back to your time in Iran, and after you left, you went to Washington. Was it at the time when Zahedi was Persian ambassador in Washington?
Yes.
Did you keep in touch with each other?
Very much so. I do now, too. He rang me the other day.
So
he was a very poor foreign minister, and by his lights, particularly with Washington, which is a very naive place, I mean, that sort of thing, they're very naive, they're children, really, Americans, when it comes to a hook-nosed Persian ambassador with bags of caviar, enormous money, and living in a sort of thing like that. They all flocked to his parties more. They were very naive in that sense, and they loved that. He was very good at it, that sort of thing. How good he was on the political side, I'm not sure it mattered very much, because he certainly made his mark there. Foreign minister, he was far too emotional. And once he threatened me once that he would repeat what Mussolini had done on Sunday. I can't remember what the issue was, but it was a ludicrous thing to threaten the British ambassador like that. And he wasn't very good, and I didn't like to get on with him when he was foreign minister. The Shah should never have appointed him foreign minister. But he was very good when he went to, good in that sense, not my sort of rather dull professional standards, but he did that job very well for the Shah. And he now, rather, he lives in Geneva. He came over the other day, not to June and Avery, and they invited me up, but June invited me up, but I couldn't go. And he's rather saying character, I think, but he keeps his respect, which is important.
And what about, you were very much interested, became interested in the Iranian special brand of mysticism called Sufism. So did you ever get in touch with the Sufi circles while you were in
With the Nematullah order, which was based on Mahan, which is this lovely place tourists very seldom go to. It's a little oasis. Is it near Yazd or Kerman? Yeah, I've forgotten. Just out beyond Kerman, on the way to Baum, I think. And quite beautiful, and it has a real spiritual feeling there. That's the 12th century, I think, Nematullah order. 12th century was unique. I mean, I think they've been trying to regurgitate the 12th century ever since. It was the most beautiful time in Persia. The greatest mystics, the greatest best writers, mostly up in that area towards the Afghan border, which is now the Afghan border there. They all lived there. And that at Gurgaon and Nishapur and all those areas there. That's the time of Persia where I liked to have lived in. I think it must have shone like a beacon in a darkened world at that time. And those people were so great, the people, that it takes centuries before there's light to die out. And I think that it has gone down. It's been obviously adulterated and darkened. I think it continued. And of the order, I don't know much about the other orders, but I think the Nematullah order has been very pure and remained very pure since, and serious. And Dr. Nurabash, who was, I think, psychology tutor, I think, at the university, had been trained as a young man and had been adopted and been a disciple and had been through the whole thing very seriously. So he'd really been through the works, which is quite a thing, because you have to be subjected wholly to your teacher and give up to him. And he continued it, but he then intellectualized it much more, which you may or may not agree with. I rather regret that. I think That's a pity. And not only a great intellectual, but externalized it by going abroad, rather only lately, of course, and starting several Hanukkahs in Los Angeles, starting Los Angeles, New York, Washington, Seattle, I've forgotten where they all over the place. Now, very popular in America, very, very alive, but very strict and very correct. No fences there. And, of course, in London, in Notting Hill Gate, near Notting Hill Gate, Chepstow Road, where they must have got well endowed by some persons, I think, a lot of money, because they bought the house next door. I don't know where the money comes from. That's very good. And I've helped them a bit with the Home Office, who would have to be cleared, and I vouch for them that they are right and correct. And so, and I've helped his wife come over here once on a visa, and I can't help his daughter, she wants to go, I can't go there. And I do that sort of thing, and I like him, and I go and see him, and he's a rather amusing and witty man. I would have thought, I don't think he's handing on very much, which he should be doing, to someone to come after him. I don't think he himself, necessarily, has reached the very great heights. I don't think that was his role. I think his role was probably the one he's performing, which is not a great high mysticism in himself, but considerable knowledge, real knowledge, of all the ingredients of what has made up the Sufism in its various forms, which is highly complicated, too complicated for me. I mean, I don't break down the spiritual experience quite in the literary way which is broken down by them, but that is how it was, and he hasn't invented these things, he's put it together. It's an encyclopedist in a way, and I no doubt he's brought a great deal of satisfaction and to a lot of people in America, and I've seen some of his young disciples in London who are very sensible and serious and joyful and happy, and what more could you give anybody as a disciple?
What about other personalities here that have sort of impressed you?
I always like everybody knew Haveda, I like him, you couldn't be more sophisticated than the man of the world than Haveda. But his was essentially a French influence, as opposed to rather than English one. I mean, his life had been very much, at the most impressionable age, been touched by the French. He retained that all his life. And it's a sort of a French wit, rather than a sense of humour. And so on. You could say that, I think. Very clever man. In an impossible position. Held that position longer than anybody else succeeded in doing. I mean, his successors tried on Musica, clever people like that. They simply hadn't got the character that he had, or the nimbleness to survive the Shah, because it was impossible to be prime minister to a Shah. I think by sheer nimbleness and wit and quickness and cleverness and knowing when to assemble, when to pass the blame onto others, and he did his best within his that character.
He didn't want to talk politics, did he?
Oh, yes.
What did he say about the situation? I mean, you said we're going too far with the petrol, quadrupling the price and that kind of thing.
I didn't talk to him about that. I don't think I talked to him because I was solely engaged with the Shah on that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that would have helped very much at the time. But I would talk on other matters. I mean, we would talk about the... anything big, like the Abu Musa, and those islands and things like that, which really might have broken off relations with Britain if we hadn't come to some solution, because Shah was so impetuous. Anything like that, he had no influence at all. And I dealt entirely with the Shah on that, and the people who came out to negotiate with me. But on that scale, I wouldn't have done, we would talk about, and he would never really unbutton very much, we would talk about Orient and British relations and setting up education, we talked about them. But he's very keen on starting the French university at Hamadan, and I wanted to do something else, that sort of thing. But he would never get into deep politics, because deep politics meant the Shah all the time, and he would never talk to me about the Shah.
He would.
Asadullah Alam was different. There I could talk about almost anything. Alam was the one confidant, the one person whom I could talk with anything that you talk to the Shah about. But it really wasn't worth one's while, frankly, to talk other than I used to see him about this or that financial matter. I'd see Haveda or some ICI or Vickers would like the privilege of this or that, or could be helped, or vice versa. I would see him or Abshah, who was the little economic minister.
Ansari,
little who was it went to his head. He became a little cock-a-hoop fellow, and. So, and I would talk with the Musica, people I get, and I would talk with them on their departmental businesses. You see.
And what about the elder statesmen who in the old days had been obviously very much in the forefront and then gradually were...
I didn't know many of them. Entezan was the one I knew, but didn't know very well, who'd been the representative at the United Nations. And who was a Sufi, I think, in his own right.
They both were. That was
I think he had a house right in the bazaar itself. Sinkunapa. And I didn't know him well, but he was there during the Musadik time too, and was an influence for good. He was always an influence for toleration and understanding. He was a very big man who got outside the irritations and frustrations of the Persian skin, which is a difficult thing to do. I don't think I would have done. I mean, more a passion about it, but I think I would have been I'd have become a Persian nationalist, I think, very strongly, and had felt all those frustrations. He had the bigness to get out and detach himself. Probably, as a trained Sufi, he was able to. But I think he's a big man, and somebody ought to remember him.
Are you talking about Abdullah, who became the head of NIOC?
Nasrullah. Who was the Sufi?
They were both.
And were they both Sufi?
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, the one I liked was the one who was at the, I think he was head of the General Assembly of the United Nations for a short time.
And you never met Abdullah, who became head of the, head of the National Iranian
Council? I probably did. I met everybody. They were a great, very good family, they were. I liked them a lot. Some of the older ones I didn't know so well. I used to go and see, who was at the time of Musadiq? He'd been a pretender, very strong man. He was in exile at that time. And I think he was very strong man. He lived out on the mountainside, living on yogurts of various kinds.
A pretender to what?
Oh, he'd been in the 30s, I think. In the 40s, he'd been a very strong opponent to Reza Shah, tried to form opposition governments. What was his name? The only one.
A tribesman? Was he the head of a tribe?
No. I can't remember his name. Anyhow, I rather admired him in his old age, I remember. But the older ones, you see, there weren't many who could live under the Shah by that time. And the old Alam, you see, I liked him, but I didn't know him. Dennis Wright would know all these people so much better, because he went back 10 years more. They were always retreated by them. Alam had retreated. They're very old man, white hair. He was terrific.
Do you mean Sid Zian?
I do, yes. And he was living on a mountainside when I went into the negotiation with Musadiq at 51. Sayed Zia. Marvelous man. A really big man. Rather like, who made Israel, went back into the desert. Looked the same, pretty shocking. They were great friends. And Sayed Zia. And at one time,
Ben-Gurion,
they were friends. They would live in the desert together. And he was really on it was a mountainside, and he was cultivating his different yogurts and things. And he had adoring women looking after him, who adored him. They liked power. You know, women who marry, who love power. You know, men with power. Women like power, you know that? Yeah, well, they do, quite apart from the physical and the other. They like, I never discovered this. Late in life, they actually liked power, and he had them, and some very intelligent followers. And he, I thought at one time he would help us, you know, we might almost bring him back again. There was a thought that we might bring him back, if only a passing one, if not a real one, and replace Musadiq with him. But it was not a real one. Anyhow, you ask who are the outstanding men I remember from the past.
You thought he was too old, or why did you think
too old?
Too old.
But he had all that charisma, immense charisma. You can tell it to the man, you know, rather like the present Prime Minister of Israel. It may be all wrong in his theories, but you can't avoid the strength of the power of his face. I don't know his face. And Sayed Zia was like that. Some men have it, others don't. Some have it to a degree, and it's repulsive. You know, it's just all power, that's too much. But he was loving and sweet, and very gallant with the ladies, had all these attributes. He was an all-around man, I thought. And so, but he was good. Who were the others? I don't remember from the earlier time. Yes.
Well, you mentioned Afshar as being a tricky fellow.
Oh, Afshar, yeah, was a poisonous man.
Why, in what way? What feeling?
Well, because he was never straight. I mean, he would say one thing to your face, and I know perfectly well, I tested this, report other things to the Shah. He'd fabricate things, and he was overwhelmingly smiling to the British and all that. I think he was very anti-British underneath. But that, I know it headed against him for that, but I mean, he just wasn't straight. And I don't think he had a friend. I don't think anybody, if you ask them privately, they were, some of them frightened of him because he was, he could do them harm. I don't think anybody, if you really ask them, probably their family, liked him. Which is always a sign there's something wrong. And it can't be a coincidence that nobody did. So that's my belief.
That's right. So he's, you mean, his period as Persian ambassador here wasn't a great success?
No, it was an absolute disaster. Just after I left, I think he succeeded Asadullah Alam as the eminence grise in the court. I think the Shah split it with somebody else, I think, mercifully. Otherwise, it would have been a awfully bad influence if he had anything to say about policies. So that's why the Shah's judgment about people was so bad. Fancy appointing little Afshar, who was a jumped-up popinjay, really. Fancy appointing him as to the great position of Minister of State, you know, of Asadullah Alam's position. Grand Vizier is what it was, Grand Vizier to the Sultan. It's exactly that position. Fancy appointing a man with no substance at all, a two-dimensional figure. I mean, the Shah's judgment was so bad. And that's the great pity. He himself, if his judgment of people had been good, if he'd been able to pick good lieutenants, like Truman, who wasn't a brilliant man, Truman had the genius of picking people like Dean Acheson, George Marshall, and that's all he had to do, and support them loyally. Brilliant. One of the greatest presidents of the United States, that's why. If the Shah had been able to do even a little bit of that, he'd have been one of the greatest rulers in the Middle East. But he simply had no capacity to pick people. If he'd been able to pick the intizams of this world and trust them to support him, he'd have been, and still been exactly, you know, worked as hard as he did, but a lot of his ideas excellent. Things would have been absolutely different. But he would pick someone like Afshar. It's the tragedy, really, of the Shah. I hadn't thought of that before, far more than all these other things we've been talking about importing, by greed, importing inflation, which destroyed the acidity of the middle class and the bazaar, big factors, upsetting the mullahs by importing vulgarity, which is also what he did, another reason why he fell, another big factor against him. I think he would have ridden out of all that if he had any good sense of picking loyal, intelligent advisers who he could trust, but he didn't trust. That must go right back to his childhood, and I suspect that growing up under this great figure without a loving mother, I didn't have a loving mother, and he never looked very loving to me, you know, maybe I can't judge that. I think he never had any trust in plotting it. That's nearer to soul murder.
What you were talking about soul murder, that's right.
Where you actually deprive the growing child, who needs it like anything, of the capacity for joy and love. And you leave the capacity for pleasure, like power, all that, but not joy or love. And that's what happened to him. I think there's a degree of soul murder somewhere in his makeup. Not his fault. That's why I think he should be rehabilitated for all these reasons.
Yes. What other sort of salient anecdotes come to your mind about your relationship with Iran?
I had quite a part to play on the 2,500 celebrations of Persepolis.
But what do you think of that? Did you think it was a good idea?
I thought it was splendid. I love jamborees, nothing better. I couldn't get the Queen to go, of course. Doesn't like jamborees. Shah was very upset.
She said, "I just don't like."
Fortunately for her, because in point of fact, she wouldn't have gone. The Queen doesn't go to collective jamborees except royal funerals. She's prepared to meet other royalty at royal funerals. She's very grand, the Queen. She won't go to a big jamboree. She won't go to a collectivity of royals and heads of states and all that, except for a funeral, which this was. So she wouldn't have gone, mercifully, and then I don't know what I would have said, because there was no possible excuse other than saying the Queen doesn't want to come. Mercifully, she'd already arranged a year before do a state tour on them in the Royal Yacht to Turkey, which you've never done before, which coincided with the 2500 celebration. It was very awkward, because it meant that she was alongside the country of Persia at the time that she was there in the vicinity, but didn't come. But that was the excuse. But he was upset about that. And then said to me, well, in that case, I'd be very honoured, indeed, I'd like to issue an invitation to the heir apparent, Prince Charles, to come in the place of the Queen. And I have to take the message back to him again, so I'm very sorry, Your Majesty. But Prince Charles is a lieutenant now in the Royal Navy, and for the next year, nothing, but nothing, can take him away from his naval duties. Not even anything as unique and as prestigious as your 2500. Charles could not accept that. He couldn't understand that. How could he understand that? Even the English find it a little harder. We understand it, because that is the naval tradition. You are serving in the Navy and you won't go for anything. But he didn't understand that, so he repeated for quite a bit, and there were sort of little waves going out of repercussions and things gathering together. Finally, we settled for Prince Philip and Princess Anne, who came out and stayed with Francis and me 2 days. We had all that, the great gardens of the embassy, we had thousands of people, mostly all the British, all the Persian, I think, there to see. And we flew down to. We raced Prince Bernhard, because he and Prince Philip both fly their own planes. And in our plane, we were terribly slow planes, they were, but they both the same. We raced down to Persepolis. It was Prince Philip, Rupert Neville, Lord Neville, who died recently, who was always with him. Francis, me, and Princess Anne. We really had a great plane now. And when we got there, they went into one of these tents, you know, in Shiraz. And it was a remarkable evening. I've still got the menu, the fantastic menu, the best wines I've ever had in my life, I think, very evening. And then we went up to the great Saint Lumière up in the Persepolis itself at night and sat all around all the crown heads of Europe, and Elis and Assis and the presidents and everybody. And they did a wonderful Saint Lumière of Alexander burning Persepolis. It was very dramatic. You can imagine the great clouds of smoke and fire came out of Persepolis out of the dark. And then the great voice of Artaxerxes II came out from that grave, that great stone grave on the hillside. Great deep voice. It was very, very well done, dramatic.
What did the voice say?
I can't, something like, I don't know, the equivalent of "My name is Ozymandias," something like that, you know. "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my work, you mighty and despair." Something like that. But it wasn't. And I'll show you, I've got some very good photographs of Princess Anne, and a marvellous Manitoba, but she'd just been to Alaska. She's just a very young girl, her first visit abroad, and they've given her, must have cost me a complete white fox skin thing, right down to her ankles, all fur, and I guess, and she's we had a very good. Now, the interesting thing of that was, I had a part to play in this, that beforehand, the head of protocol, who became ambassador, something like that, he was terribly worried, because the Shah, of course, hadn't invited the whole world, hadn't thought about the plasma. How do you do that without upsetting people? Because there would be the Sheikh of Kuwait and the President of Bulgaria. I mean, who has precedence? The King of Lesotho, or Haile Selassie, or the President of Uruguay, or Pompidou, I mean, whatever it was, you see. Pompidou didn't come in the end, that upset the Shah, but all these people, and all these beautiful, lot of beautiful young princesses, you know, were built, and they were all young in those days, all dressed up in tiaras, very beautiful, a Shah. So he said to me, the people who know most about this are the British. They are the age-long tradition. They know exactly how to do these things. We have pageants and shows and things. One thing they can't do. Could you please find out from your head of protocol what would he do with the circumstances? Because I haven't a clue. He'd say quite nice. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And then we went back to the forward. And finally, I'm hiking about, we devised, I think together, Boulevardia, in this great tent. I think it was put up by Maxim's, I think it was. It was fantastic, the decors and things. The enormous great tent of the Persepolis. It was a great tent, but all these people, must have been 100, maybe these heads. And down below, just below, were the tables. Princess Anne, and I sat at the table below, and I was one of the two, three senior ambassadors, and people around there. And then, the president of Russia was there. And what they did was, they made the top table like that, with a node, like that, you see. So you couldn't look down and see who was below you or above you. Because it was
like a snake.
A big snake. It was about five nodal points, five big sweeping nodal points.
Right.
So you couldn't look down. And each of the nodal points was either the Shah or the Shah Banu or the young heir apparent or the younger son, maybe 12, 11 or so, didn't matter, or the Queen Mother or Abdulreza or somebody. I mean, so they had everybody, but they had that, you see. Mm-hmm. And it was impossible. You couldn't work out. I mean, you couldn't see whether you were up or down, and whether you were sitting next to a sheikh or whoever. And that was very good. And then Prince Philip told me the next morning, we were driving together. I brought my rolls down, I think, for the occasional flown it down. And we were driving around. We went on for a day or two. And he told me an amusing story. That he and Prince Bernhard, they were other pals, you see. And both of them were, is it morganatic? I mean, they married. Their wives were the sovereigns. They were the sovereigns. They were the big ones. How did the story go? Yes. They were. And then Prince Bernhard said the next day, morning, how was it, Philip, you noticed that. We are down the other end of the table, the ladies were mixed together, but you and I, I had the President of Bulgaria on my right and the Sultan of Oman on my left, and you had the President of Austria on your left and the Sultan of something on your right, the army of the men. And Prince Philip said, but don't you realize, Bernard, that's quite understandable, after all, you and I are a couple of royal queens. Which is rather nice. I think that's right, I may have got the story wrong, but it's something like that.
But a lot of people have said, in retrospect, that the Jamboree, the 2500th anniversary of monarchy, was a tremendous mistake in that a great deal of money was spent ostentatiously where the rest of the country was still not very rich, and that it caused resentment
in Persia?
In Persia, and that it didn't serve any purpose except for giving ammunition to the opposition, to the mullahs, and so forth and so on.
I don't think, well, I was there too, for, it happened in my first 6 months, I think, so I was there 2 years after, and I heard none of that then. I think that's all retrospective stuff. On the contrary, I think it did, I mean, insofar as a Persian is a patriot, it did a lot of good for his or her country. It put Persia, Iran on the map. There were people, when I was in the United States afterwards, in little places, Oklahoma, oh gee, where you at Persepolis at the thing? They actually knew where Persia was, they never knew before. It was the biggest way, if that was what they wanted, very successful way of putting Persia on the international map. And they succeeded. And people knew about that. I remember the Shah, it used to annoy the Shah that Iran and Iraq sound the same to other people. And I exploited that, because I said one day to the Shah, quite early on actually, I said, Your Majesty, you know, in England, where we have the oldest relationship with your country, anybody, our first ambassador was there, the 17th century, the people are still very muddled now. Now you call yourself Iran. They know Persia. We know about Persian poetry and the Persian language and Persian this and Persian that, Persian history. But we don't know Iran. And they muddled up with Iraq, which is a new country too, and it's very difficult. And they often attribute things to Persia. They should attribute to Iraq. And he loathed Iraq, you see. But I said, may I have your permission in my speeches and around the country and so on to talk about Persia? I know it's not an accurate designation. Reza Shah was right that so on. I go, but from the point of view of my country, oh yes, he said certainly. I used to annoy, and I never told Haveda, and I remember annoying Haveda very much at some, we had public functions where we both were making speeches, and I was talking about Persia all the time, and he was very upset, and was going to make a fuss about it, and I told that chap who became ambassador here, the little fellow, who was his private secretary?
Raji.
I told Raji, I said, out of kindness, I said, stop Herveda making a thing of this, because he was nice to tease the British ambassador to make a thing of it, because the Shah has given me permission, and he'd be glad if I do this. So that shut it all down. That's how that was.
That one everybody objects to in retrospect, and also of course the Shiraz Arts Festival, this is another thing that everybody objects to.
But then I think that started off very well, that was very right, and then I think she was badly advised. I think the Shabanoon, wanting to emphasize modernity, or having been brought up as an architect in Paris and all that, I think she wanted to bring modernity to her people in a way. She overdid it, I think. And I think a lot of the Mullah, not even the Mullah, the people were shocked by some of the vulgarity, these exposures and the sexual intonations and all that, or some of the pieces she brought in. It was a great mistake. I think she could have done it and sustained it on a higher level without doing it. It's all right in England or America. We are used to that and absorb it. The permissive society is part of our experience, but it wasn't so at that time, and I think she went too quickly. But the idea was very good, and some of the Peterborough productions were excellent. Your friend Tom Hughes, Ted Hughes, remember, they had one of his.
That's right, yes. What happened to, did you have any dealings with the Shah one?
Yes. My wife, Frances, particularly, and she did, I got them somewhere, they did this great historic pageant of reconstructing all the costumes of the ladies of Iran going back 2,000 years. And they did a great pageant of it. It took a long time. They made the dresses and all that, and the Shah Banu was patroness of it and did it with her. And then when anybody of distinction came out, women of distinction, Frances were taken to see the Shah Banu. And I would talk to her. I liked her very much. She would go to Kerman, for instance, take her Veda with her. And really, because she was a co-ruler, I remember, at one time. She wasn't just the Shah Banu. Do you know that, didn't you? She was co-ruler. And if there'd been a regency, you know, if she'd have taken on, she'd survive. And she did a lot of good work. And people, I went to Kerman afterwards, and the people were talking about it, and how intelligent she was, and good suggestions and things. And the Shah, I think he put her down quite a lot, because she went on, you know, he behaved badly with other women and all that she'd normally do. But I think he respected her. And I think she had influence on him on the cultural side. I don't think any influence at all on politics at all. I asked Asadullah that once. But the cultural side, I think he did respect what she did. Otherwise he wouldn't have allowed her to do her Shiraz. I think she was a great lady. She looked magnificent in her scabbed out.
Anybody else or any other anecdotes or episodes that you can remember which would have any bearing on the events? Or
how that happened afterwards, at the yes. time one didn't think. I remember my last, we always write a valedictory dispatch before we go, which the ambassador has to do without consulting anybody. I mean, most of our dispatches on technical stuff, you have a member of your staff who helps you prepare it. Valedictory one really must be genuinely, rather what I'm doing now, I mean, summing up what the ambassador feels from the day of his arrival. You write one as soon as you arrive, first impressions, as you call. Mm-hmm. Then you write one when you go. And at the end, I thought, looking round, and that at the end of 73, I think I was right at the time, I could not see anything that would undermine the Shah. He had total control over the armed forces, total control over Sabak. He had the succession lined up, he'd arranged for the regency and all that. He was, and again, just doing his OPEC price rise at that moment, so I couldn't evaluate the consequences of that. But I did remember, even then, I did write a paragraph or so about the Mullahs, saying I thought the Mullahs would be getting restless, and that this importing this all this vulgarity of Western civilization, or American vulgarity in particular, which is always bad luck. It's not America, I know it. It's always the vulgar side, as they say, that gets exported. It's historical, and from Britain too. That was irking people. I mean, you went to see the change in Tehran. You went to any very nice, reasonable doctor in Tehran. They all have swimming pools and things, but you shouldn't be able to make that sort of money as a doctor so quickly in any proper society. And that was having its effect, I thought. And I thought that the out in the country too. It was going too quickly, the secularization of the, and so on. And that might cause him trouble.
You said that.
It's in my, that to be published, whatever it is, in the 30 years from 1973, I suppose. Halfway there, another 15 years.
Yes.
All those things. That'll be, I mean, one says what one can, and that is an historical record, but it didn't do any good, really.
Yeah, but you didn't give it to him, did you?
Yeah.
Well, so he wouldn't have known what you thought about it.
Yeah, but I talked to Asadura about it. You see, Asadura wouldn't, even he, no one had closer access, and no one had more, was less fearful in talking to the Shah. He wouldn't have dared to do it either. Because he was a lonely man, the Shah. He did not encourage advice he didn't want to hear. And that was one of the troubles. Pity. In his own way, I mean, he's now made out to be a sort of a shallow man. And he, fascinating fact, he started as a tormented little boy, I expect, for all these reasons. Spoke beyond measure, given his wonderful education, highly intelligent. And then he went through this weak playboy period where he was really cut a very poor figure at the Masonic time, and then sobered up for the reasons I've given. And then, at a time, I think he won the mission for my country. He really set about from the 1960s onward doing remarkable things for his country. Perhaps he should have died in his early 60s. That would be all right.
But he did die in his early 60s.
For his record. Well, he wasn't, was it early 60s? Yes, it would have been early 60s. Well, perhaps earlier. 50s, yes. That's right.
You mean he should have died 10 years earlier than he did?
I think so, probably, yes. From his point of view. Then the question of whether he should take refuge in England, you see. When he was over in the States, he wanted to.
So what happened? Did you?
We had to persuade him. Yes, I was governor of Bermuda at that time. But I couldn't go. I would have thought that I might be sent to talk to him. But I couldn't go. No, Dennis Wright went, you see.
Okay.
Yes. But I don't think if you see Dennis Wright, I wouldn't ask him that.
No. He went to see
him. It was all right for the year 2000.
Yes, right? Quite exactly. But he went to see him to say what? You can come to England
No, to explain why he could not. An easy thing to do.
Why couldn't he?
Because it would have been put our whole embassy at risk in Tehran. We weren't prepared to do that.
Your embassy was at risk. I mean, you haven't got an embassy even to this day.
But we did then. We had then. We only lost our embassy after the American hostages.
So he went all the way to America to explain to the Shah why he couldn't come to Britain.
Well, somebody had to explain to him.
But what does it matter if you could have closed your embassy for the time being?
No. No, we wanted to keep our embassy open. And there are other reasons, I've forgotten now, why it wasn't, it wouldn't have been prudent for him to come to Britain. I think there were too many other things at risk. I forgot one of the reasons. I don't think he was very insistent. I think he was in Mexico, wasn't he, or something. Far better him to be in a country which didn't have an embassy at risk. Why risk other people's lives?
So poor Dennis was put into this very embarrassing position.
I don't think embarrassed. I mean, I'd have done it. Anyway, they thought that I was governor at the time. Dennis had retired. They didn't want to involve me. It'd be easier, really, for me. I know he wasn't embarrassing, I don't think. I think the Shah knew it. He knew the answer, really. It was obvious. Being an intelligent man, he knew the calculations about as good as anybody.
According to what I have heard, and everybody confirms this, that he was extremely tolerant of that kind of thing, that he very fully understood.
He understood
the raison d'etat of various people.
He'd done it himself. I mean, it's not very difficult. If you live yourself with those calculations, scheming and calculations, you make exactly the same arguments, arrangements. I mean, you know what the other side is going to say. I mean, I don't think it's hardly worth going to tell him. But it was a polite way of doing it. He liked Dennis, and so it was a polite, rather nice gesture, rather than send him a message.
Nonetheless, everybody seems to agree. Everybody I have talked to for the series as well as otherwise, that the way the Shah and the Shah Bani were treated after the Nevzian, by everybody, all the people who had got money and help from them, advice and help and everything, and then turned them down, was pretty awful, very dishonorable.
Are you saying that you ought to have been allowed to go to Britain? I don't think he wanted to, particularly.
No, I mean, what I'm saying is that people shouldn't have just dropped him who had benefited from him.
Didn't they? Who, for instance?
Well, just about everybody except Nasser and the King of Morocco.
Oh. I bet the King of Jordan didn't.
No, he didn't.
He's a very loyal man.
Morocco and President Sadat were the only three people who stood by him.
Jordan, yes, he would. Very loyal people. Well, that's the world. It's not a world of love. It's a hard world. That it's not like human relationships. In human family or other patterns. It's a hard world. In the Shah, we've done the same. That's how it was. I'm not talking about nice people in that sort of romantic way. I'm talking about historical personages. And that's why, he, as a historical person, he ought to be rehabilitated. I'm not rehabilitating his character. The man was not a dummy in your sense, but I mean, he was almost fatal. I mean, the conditions of his environment, upbringing, and so on,